Well, thank you all for being here. I really appreciate it. And as Ted said, I have been the chair of political science at Duquesne actually for a while. For about the last 10 years, I've been very interested in looking at what I've called the global right wing. And I wrote this book, published it in 2012. It's a book that followed on some other research that I'd done about more left-wing globalization and global activism. After I finished that book, which looked a lot at human rights groups and environmental groups and social justice groups that were working around the world to try to change politics at the UN and in various countries, I realized there were some real strong opponents to the left who were working globally. And I decided, well, no one had really looked at those right-wing groups, and I decided it was time for someone to do so. So I spent about 4 years doing research on the global right, and it wasn't just on the global religious right, which I'm going to talk about today. Let me just give you a couple of other examples of it. And one thing I particularly focused on was the clash between left and right. So on what I call security issues, things like gun control within countries and at the United Nations, there have long been efforts to reduce the number of guns worldwide, the amount of gun violence, the number of people killed by guns. But at the same time, at the UN, our very own National Rifle Association has been very active, actually has consultative status at the UN, so it can go to all UN meetings. They've formed an international network of pro-gun groups from around the world, and I actually spent quite a bit of time in Brazil doing some really interesting research about how the NRA went down there and helped reshape their gun politics and more generally their politics towards the right, and we now have a very right-wing president in Brazil. Another area that I looked at was environmental issues, and I think we're all familiar with global efforts to, for instance, reduce climate change, try to stem global warming. But as I think many of us are aware, there are a lot of opponents to those efforts. And they're not just here in the United States, but also globally. And they, too, have very strong networks that try to basically either deny that global warming is occurring, or if they don't deny it, just try to create policies that aren't as coercive, aren't as significant in trying to prevent global warming. A third area I did look at was human rights issues, and groups like Amnesty International, Human Rights Watch, various gay rights groups are very well known, I think, both domestically and internationally. But the thing that I found, and which I'll be talking mostly about today, is that the right wing has been very active as well in trying to oppose those kinds of issues. And doing research at the United Nations again, I interviewed people and met lots of people from groups like these from around the world. I also spent quite a bit of time, and I'll talk about that perhaps next week, looking at how these groups work, not only in the United States, but also in countries like Sweden and Romania, where I did research as well. So I would be happy to talk about other aspects of the global right wing, but today I will really focus on the global religious right. And just to start, I'll talk about a few of the key actors in the global religious right. Some of them I think you may have heard of, perhaps LifeSite News, which is a major media center for Christian right activism. I'm sure many of you have heard of the World Congress of Families, which is in many ways the most important, at least domestically, of these organizations, and the World Congress of Families in particular has created a global network that meets annually and does work around the world on a variety of issues that are dear to the religious right. The other two groups I'll talk a little bit about as well. Advocates International is a legal advocacy group with conservative Christian lawyers here in the United States who go overseas, train lawyers to work in their own country's courts and follow a lot of the same strategies that we've seen here in the United States, both by lawyers on the left and by lawyers on the right. And CFAM, that's a Catholic organization that works exclusively at the United Nations on these kinds of issues as well, and I'll speak a bit more about them. But let me just focus for a moment on the World Congress of Families. Here you see the leader of the World Congress, Alan Carlson. He formed the World Congress of Families in 1997, so it's a relatively new group. He is both a scholar and an activist. He's written a number of very interesting books on family issues, but they're both scholarly and very much activist types of publications as well. The World Congress of Families, as I said, meets annually and around the world. The last couple of years in various parts of Europe, Eastern Europe has been a big area for growth among the network of conservative religious groups, and especially Russia, with the Russian Orthodox Church becoming very closely allied with the World Congress of Families. As many of you know, the Russian Orthodox Church is pretty closely allied with the Russian state as well. So there's a lot of controversy about just how, what degree the Russian state is using Russian orthodoxy and so-called traditional values as a foreign policy tool. And I'll talk more about that as well. What are the goals that the religious right seeks? Well, in just a few words, they talk frequently about preserving what they call traditional values and defending the natural family. And those concepts are, you know, very vague in some ways, but they encompass a great number of specific policy issues on which the religious right focuses. The traditional values idea is one that particularly the Russian Orthodox Church promotes, and Russia itself at this point. And basically the idea is that they want to protect the way religion has been a central part of people's lives for, you know, since time immemorial, really. And they want to continue to keep that very central focus on religion. And related to that, on the role of what they call the natural family, meaning the man and woman in marriage with children, hopefully lots of children. The natural family idea, I think, is that people have as many children as possible and not be limited by modern technologies, contraception, and so forth. But there's another sort of flip side of all of this, of course, and that is that by promoting traditional values and the natural family, the religious right around the world is rejecting a whole broad set of new sort of socially liberal values, which are really kind of encompassed under the terminology sexual orientation and gender identity. That's, I have that in quotes, in part because at the United Nations, that is a term of art that many left-wing pro-gay rights organizations are trying to insert into various conventions and treaties that don't necessarily have anything directly to do with the family. But the religious right is very staunchly opposing any type of mention at all of this type of terminology. So, for instance, back in the late 1990s, when the United Nations was looking into the creation of the International Criminal Court, which is supposed to try war criminals for a variety of different types of crimes, there was a lot of controversy about whether this terminology should be placed in there in the context of war crimes maybe directed against those who are gay. And the religious right was adamant that that should not be in there. and played a big role in actually keeping it out. And there have been many other examples of treaties and conventions centered on the UN, which seemingly have very little to do with these core issues of defending the natural family. Yet, because this terminology is seen as so dangerous by the religious right, they will fight tooth and nail on a whole variety of issues to keep that particular terminology out. So, of course, what it suggests is the idea that we should have things like abortion, gay rights, same-sex marriage, but also things which maybe aren't quite as obvious, like homeschooling, which I think here in the United States we're very familiar with homeschooling, pretty comfortable with it. In a lot of parts of Europe, homeschooling is actually illegal. And the religious right has been working to try to change that because many conservative religious families in countries like Germany reject public education because it doesn't have a religious component in it. Also, things like in vitro fertilization would be something that the core concepts of the natural family would go against, and sexual orientation and gender identity would be sort of the large encompassing context in which this kind of issue would play out. Now, I've mentioned mostly the United Nations so far on this concept, but the photo that's actually on the cover of my book, and I've enlarged it here, is of a protest in Uganda against a very in favor of a very harsh anti-gay law, nicknamed the Death to Gays Law, which was proposed and actually put into place in Uganda in the mid-2000s, which created a huge amount of controversy worldwide. Huge amount of opposition, of course, from Western Europe, the United States, and especially various LGBT rights groups. But the religious right, at least some parts of the religious right, went to Uganda and basically tried to promote this law. I think many of them, like this Mormon who is part of a protest in Kampala, Uganda, wanted to get rid of the death penalty and even life imprisonment in the law, but they, the law was very harsh, and overall, the religious right internationally became involved in a good number of countries in Africa in which these kinds of laws have been promoted and actually put into place. And in a lot of ways, although some of the main conflict takes place at the United Nations, in a lot of ways, the most strenuous kind of conflict is occurring in individual countries. So these are the kind of goals that the religious right focuses on at the policy level. I think underlying it all is this idea that we want to get back to a kind of a traditional lifestyle. And the man I mentioned before, Alan Carlson, has written this book, which I think goes to the whole idea that we need to, A, have traditional families with sort of men in the head of them, women taking care of the children, and lots of children. But also, interestingly, saying that living in cities in particular is inimical to that kind of lifestyle, and so we should move back to a more rural existence where this might be possible. Whether that's really possible or not, it's hard to say. Whether people would really want to do that or not, it's hard to say. But there is this much deeper philosophical, I'd say, critique of modern society, especially modern urban society, that's actually part of this religious right viewpoint, which interestingly also kind of jibes with some on the left wing who also call for some changes in that direction. So one of the key things I looked at in the book, one of the most interesting things for me, is how these religious right actors actually try to achieve some of the goals we just talked about. What do they actually do? Well, one of the most important things is that they form these transnational networks. Most of the organizations that I looked at in my research are nationally based. We have numerous of them in the United States, but many countries around the world also have their own sort of indigenous national organizations trying to promote religiously conservative values like the ones I've just mentioned. But especially since the early 1990s, we've also seen this networking across national boundaries. What's particularly interesting is that networking has not been confined just to Christian groups, although Alan Carlson considers himself a conservative evangelical. He's been happy to reach out to the Catholic Church, which has had its own indigenous, long-standing conservative views about the family and certainly about sexual orientation and gender identity. So the church hierarchy in particular, depending on who's the pope, it makes some difference, but certainly Pope Benedict was very conservative on these issues, very active at the United Nations, where the Vatican has a seat equivalent to that of a country. They've been very, very active there, and the Christian right has reached out to the Catholic hierarchy, and to some extent, conservative Catholic laity as well. The organization I mentioned a moment ago, CFAM, which is a small but I think really powerful organization based in New York, has been a big part of the networking that's gone on as well. But even more interestingly, the Christian and Catholic groups involved have reached out to Islamic organizations. The Organization of the Islamic Conference is actually the organization, an international organization of Islamic countries around the world, many of which, of course, are quite religiously conservative. And despite the fact that there's some obvious differences between Christian right, especially, and various Islamic countries and Muslim beliefs, on certain key issues regarding the family and social values, there's a lot of overlap. And these groups have not let their differences get in the way. They have joined together in what I called in my book the Baptist Burqa Coalition. That's a kind of a, it was meant to maybe get some laughs or at least be just a shorthand way to remember what's happening here. It's based on the concept you may have heard of a Baptist bootlegger coalitions that worked together to create prohibition because one was against it, was against liquor on moral grounds, the other wanted prohibition because they could make money off of it by bootlegging. Basically what it means is that you have a strange bedfellows coalition, people you wouldn't expect getting together to work for a particular goal. And that's exactly what's happened with the Baptist Burqa Coalition at the UN and in many countries around the world where there's conflict between those promoting these social liberal values and those in favor of traditional values. So the Christian right has not been at all reluctant to form these coalitions, form alliances, and they respect each other very much across these alliances. Some of the most interesting interviews and information I got about these activities were quotes from people who, maybe in a Mormon group, who talk about how much they respect someone from an Islamic country's embassy who's worked with them for years on these issues. Now, when I was doing this work in most of my research on this coalition in the early 2000s or mid-2000s, this was the main way in which I saw this strange bedfellows coalition taking place. But increasingly, after this book was published in 2012, the Orthodox Church and the Russian state have gotten very, very involved in this network and in fighting some of the battles that it fights. So I've now sort of renamed it the Baptist Burqa Babushka Coalition to signify, you know, the traditional values that the Russian Orthodox Church very, very strongly promotes. And I have, obviously, this is I guess you can barely see Putin's up there as well. I don't think he takes a direct role in this, but he has sort of transformed himself, of course, from a communist to now a defender of traditional values. And working with or certainly permitting the Russian Orthodox Church to work with Christian right, Catholic, and Muslim groups around the world, traditional values coalition has become all the stronger, especially at the United Nations and in Eastern Europe, I think, where Russian Orthodox Church has been particularly powerful. So these are all part of one key strategy, which is basically just enlarging your power by reaching out to groups around the world who think the same way as you do, at least on particular policy issues, even if, you know, in terms of your actual faith, it is very, very different. A second strategy that these organizations have used, I've kind of alluded to it already, is that they spend a lot of time lobbying at international organizations. Most importantly, the United Nations, but also at the European Union, European Parliament, and a number of other international organizations. And they see these organizations as a profound threat. This has gone back really for decades that I think many on the nationalist and to some extent the religious right have seen internationalism as a threat to traditional values. And so it's, I'd say, maybe no surprise that they have devoted a lot of attention to work at these organizations. What is a little bit more surprising is that it's not just work from the outside, just attacking them as being, you know, terrible threats to national sovereignty and national religious traditions, but what they've actually done is become members of these organizations and try to work from the inside to reduce the ways in which the UN or the EU could affect the what they see as their critical issues on social values and family life. And as I've already suggested, they've been very, very successful on that. Particularly at the UN, they've been helped by the Holy See, the Vatican, which has, as I said, the same status as states in the UN. The fact that the Organization of Islamic Conference is now in their network as well makes a huge difference, because you then have several dozen states who can veto particular policies or vote against them. And as well with Russia in the network as well now, that gives a huge amount of power, since Russia actually has a Security Council seat. So that is just another way in which these groups are very, very active there. And I did, again, a lot of interviewing with activists who spend a lot of time there. They train one another. This pro-family negotiating guide is just one example of the way in which they try to train people, especially maybe from conservative African countries who haven't had as much experience working at the UN as some of the long-standing American groups. It's a focus that they see as really critical, and so they're spending a lot of time bringing people up from the lower ranks to make them very good negotiators. The other critical thing that they do as a strategy is pressuring national governments within states themselves. And of course, I think we're very familiar with that in the United States, and the Christian right, the moral majority, however you want to name it, has been very, very powerful for decades within our country. In a lot of ways, you could say they have lost the sort of cultural side of the battle, at least for the moment, I'd say. We have abortion legally in the country. LGBT rights have been on the rise, transgender rights more recently, same-sex marriage. All of those things sort of on a cultural level, I think, have been relatively well accepted in the United States. But politically and in the courts, they're fighting back very strongly. And I think the election of Donald Trump has been a huge shot in the arm to the groups here in the United States. Donald Trump, despite his personal libertine background, has been a big supporter of a lot of the policies that these groups are trying to promote here in the United States. And of course, his ability to appoint Supreme Court justices means that even if the cultural shift has gone as far as it has, that there may be some retrenchment as a result of that from the political and judicial level. But that's just one of many examples across the world, of course. And these groups working together trading ideas, giving strategies, and including legal strategies to one another across national borders has been a really important part of the way in which these groups fight what they see as a global culture war. I think we've heard the term culture wars for years in the United States, but it clearly, definitely has been globalized, and I'll talk a little bit about some of the battles in various countries in a little bit. But clearly, in terms of actual effect on people's lives, it's the national level laws and policies that make the biggest difference. The United Nations, it's almost more of a symbolic aspect to this, but at the national level, those types of laws make a huge difference. And of course, they've opened a lot to new sexual identities in the last few decades, but I personally don't think that that's necessarily secure. I do think, despite the cultural shift, the political game is obviously of critical importance, and to the extent that they can have a lot of effect on national political parties and political leaderships, many of these policies could be very much under threat. Actually, just one thing. You see here a protest in France. France, too, has been on the sort of cutting edge now of promoting these various laws for gender rights and same-sex marriage as well. But there's been a huge backlash there as well. And this is part of a protest that's... there have been protests by groups against the legalization of same-sex marriage now for years in France. The national politics there is a little bit more difficult to shift once it's gone in one direction, but there's been huge upset among a significant, especially rural part of the population, against some of the changes there. And I think this is true in many other countries around the world as well. And just to differentiate slightly from just electoral politics, the courts have been a venue in which the Christian right has been particularly active. It's also, by the way, a venue in which a lot of the battles over rights on the gay rights and same-sex marriage have, of course, been won and lost, and abortion for that matter. So the Christian right has not thrown in the towel at all on the courts, and nor have other right-wing groups from other faiths around the world. Instead, they have used national-level courts and international courts, especially in the European context, the European Court of Human Rights, which does have a significant amount of power. And you see here on the left a family that was actually, children were taken away from the family because they were being homeschooled, and the parents were fined in Germany. And American lawyers from a group called the Homeschool Legal Defense Association went to Germany and helped end what they perceived as persecution of this family. And I think from the American perspective, it seems very surprising that this would be something that would be illegal and people would actually have their children taken away from them for. On the right, that is a photo from a protest around a court decision at the European Court of Human Rights concerning crucifixes in Italian public school classrooms. And the European Court of Human Rights at first allowed some secular groups to win a case which removed those crucifixes. Christian right groups from the United States and from all over Europe came to the defense of the crucifix and actually had that decision reversed on appeal. So the courts have been very, very active at the international and the national level as a strategy that these groups have pursued. So what I want to do now is kind of look at one example of the global culture wars, which is a term that's been used by a number of people. I think it's appropriate when we look at battles over abortion rights, for sure, which have taking place for decades now in the United Nations and in numerous countries with international support. But and I can talk a little bit about that if anyone would like to. But the focus I wanted to have is on LGBT rights. And I do think, although I've talked mostly about the global right wing so far, that you just can't look at them in isolation. It's clearly a conflict or even a culture war between at least two sides, with the left, if you will, or certainly LGBT rights groups, human rights groups, promoting the LGBT rights agenda, including equality under the law within countries, including same-sex marriage, adoption of children by gay couples. So to think about this kind of conflict, we have to know a little bit about some of the left-wing groups that have promoted these ideas. So here's some examples of them going back decades, back into the 1970s, when one of them, the ILGA, the International Lesbian and Gay Association, was founded in Holland. Another one, International Gay and Lesbian Human Rights Commission, it's an American group but with international focus, that was founded in the 80s. They got a lot of support from major funders like the Ford Foundation early on, and from certain countries back in the 70s and 80s, just a few, mostly European countries like Holland, was very much in favor of expanding gay rights early on and even accepting same-sex marriage. Later, other organizations became involved. One interesting kind of footnote here is that human rights groups for a long time actually rejected the idea of LGBT rights. They felt like their focus should be much more on political persecution, not on more social types of persecution. So they were somewhat late to come to the support of gay rights promotion around the world. But beginning in the early to mid-90s, major groups like Amnesty International and Human Rights Watch began to promote these ideas and became very powerful parts of the network. Also in the 90s, countries like Brazil adopted significant gay rights policies and became big promoters of gay rights, along with Western European countries. The United States has been much more ambivalent. It's hinged completely on who's in the White House. And that goes for a lot of the issues I've looked at here. The president has so much power over foreign policy that we've seen sharp shifts on issues like international abortion rights, on LGBT rights, depending on who is in the White House. So this was the sort of part of the left-wing side, if you will, of the global culture wars. And their goals, of course, were to bring LGBT rights to individual countries. They did that on a national level. But also to try to change the way the United Nations thought of LGBT rights. And no international human rights convention actually has anything about gay rights at this point. The major human rights conventions, which were signed and ratified in the 1940s and the 1950s, really, it wasn't even on their radar screen at all. So more recently, these gay rights groups have tried to bring in that concept I mentioned a moment ago of sexual orientation and gender identity into amendments to some of these treaties or into new treaties and conventions on totally separate issues, but ones in which they want to give special protection to homosexuals. So this has been a very important goal that these groups have tried to achieve, and they have actually seen international treaties as a real opportunity for them to achieve their goals. Because in a number of countries, especially conservative countries in Africa and the Middle East, there's just no way that these kind of laws are going to be put into place at the national level. So the international groups have tried to promote these concepts and ideas at the international level, which I think is a very good strategy to take. If you can't actually achieve things domestically, then you go to a different level of the political system, even though it's not as powerful a level, but you try to get things done there. And so that's an important strategy that they've tried to follow. And they have very talented international lawyers who've tried to do that for many decades now. Anyway, at the UN, which I want to focus on, there have been clashes between left and right, between the traditional values network and the human rights and gay rights groups. And to me, one of the most interesting things is how deep and pervasive these conflicts actually are. They go to every aspect of this kind of issue, and it's suggesting that finding any lasting compromise is probably impossible. But let me just go through the ways in which these groups actually differ from one another and the kind of tactics they use against one another to try to win at least a temporary victory. One of the first and I think most basic questions that has to be answered is who can participate in debates over these issues at all. And until the early 1990s, there really was no voice at the UN for gay rights. But in the 90s, thanks to the work of countries like Holland, the International Lesbian and Gay Association became a part of the UN system as a non-governmental organization in consultative status to the UN. And they wanted very much to have that status because with that status, they could attend UN meetings, conventions were discussed and negotiated in many different conferences around the world. Most of those conventions and conferences, as I've talked about, didn't really focus on gay rights, but in women's rights conferences and in conferences on environment and development, gay rights groups attended and tried to get states to pay much more attention to their issues and were relatively successful. So participation was a really critical thing for these groups to do. Now, ILGA is actually a network of hundreds of different gay rights groups around the world. And what happened shortly after they gained consultative status is that one of the conservative groups, which was closely monitoring ILGA, found that one member of that group was a group that promoted pedophilia, called the North American Man-Boy Love Association. And ILGA had allowed that group to be part of their network for years. I don't think there were many people in ILGA generally who were promoting pedophilia, but this group was part of their network. So the Christian right found out about this and attacked ILGA's consultative status because they had this member promoting, in many places, is a crime. And this was a very, very effective tactic. The goal of the tactic was to get ILGA expelled from the United Nations in that consultative status. And they actually succeeded, especially with help of the United States delegation and pressure from, you may remember, Senator Jesse Helms. He was adamant and very loud-voiced about getting ILGA expelled or the United States would end its contributions to the United Nations. So ILGA was expelled. So the key point for me is that these groups are fighting over who can even have a voice in the United Nations on these kinds of issues and using some somewhat underhanded tactics. And interestingly as well, what ultimately happened was that the ILGA itself then expelled NAMBLA. So after doing that, about a decade after, they were readmitted into United Nations consultative status. But importantly, what the Christian right had done was basically forced their opponents to restructure themselves and get rid of a long-standing member of their network. Now, you might think this is kind of a maybe somewhat underhanded tactic that only the right is using, but actually, it's not the case. As I mentioned before, the Holy See, the Vatican, has been a very big anchor of the Traditional Values Coalition at the United Nations. And they have long had the status of essentially a country. giving them huge power compared to any of the non-governmental organizations there. So in response to that, a group calling itself the Sea Change Movement was formed among human rights groups and gay rights groups to try to expel the Holy See from its status at the UN, to reduce it from this country status to a mere NGO status, putting it on the same level as other countries. And that actually did not succeed, but it, I think, is a good indication of how both sides are trying to reduce the participation by the other side to weaken them in this long-standing battle. But it goes way beyond that. Let me take a drink here. There's huge controversy, of course, over the claims that each side makes on these issues. For the gay rights groups, the concept of sexual orientation and gender is a scientifically based concept that has the imprimatur of groups like the American Psychological Association and many scientific bodies around the world. And from the standpoint of gay rights groups, the concept of having a variety of sexual orientations as a normal part of human existence, the concept of there being multiple gender identities, is scientific fact. But for the Christian right, for the Catholic Church, for Muslim countries, it's seen as non-scientific, or the concept, the terminology that the Holy See typically uses is incoherent. It doesn't match up with the natural law or the way in which, you know, we ordinarily understand human sexuality and human identity. And so they reject what the other side says is a scientific claim. Meanwhile, the gay rights and human rights groups reject the idea that we should be, what they would say, imposing religious values onto science. So in terms of the basic claims, the basic even understanding of what is knowledge, these groups are in some ways almost on different planets, and there's not a good way to see how you can compromise between those two. On a more concrete issues, same-sex marriage, which has been, of course, a huge controversy, maybe not so much over the last few years since the Supreme Court decision in the United States, but it's a huge controversy before that in the U.S. and still in many countries around the world. Many, of course, in the LGBT community see it as a basic human right, something which they deserve like any other human beings. But for the Christian right, it's something catastrophic. And the argument is that if you allow same-sex marriage, the human population will begin to collapse, what they call demographic winter, and civilization itself will disappear. People will not have children, they'll not be marrying in, men and women won't be marrying, and the result will be this human catastrophe. And they bring out demographers from around the world who talk about the fall off in births that we've certainly seen in countries as they become wealthier, and they portray this as at least in part a result of the sexual revolution and the rise of same-sex marriage, more specifically. In addition, what's I found particularly interesting is that these groups fight over what religion actually says about homosexuality. And you might think that would be something that the human rights and gay rights groups wouldn't want to touch. But the Christian groups and Muslim groups as well highlight the idea that religious values, the Bible, says that homosexuality is wrong. It's an established religious value. We should not change that. What was very eye-opening to me is that religious right, the the human rights groups have tried to argue, using a significant amount of money from organizations like the Arcus Foundation, that we need to think of the Bible and religious values as evolving, and we can find terms, passages in the Bible that suggest that, in fact, gay rights should be accepted under biblical teachings. So, in other words, certain issues that you would think would be only of interest to one side, the religious texts, are actually fought over as well by both sides in this culture war clash. Finally, in the process of making changes at the United Nations, as I alluded to a moment ago, the human rights groups have seen international law as an opportunity, a way of getting their goals achieved. And what they've tried to do is not create a new international treaty to promote gay rights, but instead to make what they call incremental changes in existing treaties or in new treaties that are being promoted. So mostly, a word trying to insert that sexual orientation and gender identity concept into any number of different treaties, but also lower level types of documents produced by the United Nations. Their hope is, to the extent that that takes place, there'll be a slow change at the international level towards acceptance of that concept. But a change in the norms and maybe even the law at the international level. But groups like CFAM, which have some very talented lawyers in them as well, have basically argued that this is an illegitimate way of using international law. And they have instead said that the only true international law is when countries actually sign and ratify treaties, and they fight tooth and nail to keep that terminology, sexual orientation and gender identity, out of any such convention. And they argue that to the extent it's even mentioned at the UN outside of a treaty or convention, it's meaningless, has no effect. So this is another way in which they fight on the level of process at the UN. So what's been the upshot of all this? Sexual orientation and gender identity at the UN has not been accepted in any major treaty. The terminology is used in debates, but at least so far, this Baptist Burka Babushka coalition, the Traditional Values Coalition, has been able to prevent what very powerful entities on the left have been trying to promote. In other words, this much broader acceptance of gay rights at the international level that would jibe with what's happened in much of Western Europe, but that does not jibe very well with what's happened in much of Africa, the Middle East, many other countries around the world. So overall, to just conclude, the culture wars are very much ongoing at the international level. The global right, religious right, has been very active in it now for decades. And I think, they've been successful to the extent that they have prevented direct attacks on what they see as their core values, at least at the international level. They see that as effective, even if they've lost some of the battles within countries. And most importantly, they believe that if they can hold things off at the international level, they can come roaring back within countries. And I think we know that the culture wars are not over within our own country either, and that's true in most countries around the world as well. So I'll leave it right at that, and we have a few more minutes for questions, and be happy to take them. Ted.
So I'm interested in how these coalitions manage to get over some of the really profound cultural differences between different countries, between different religious traditions. That seems like amazing that you can do that, and I'm wondering where the stress points are.
Yeah, well, that, to me, it was amazing, too, I have to say. That was one of the most eye-opening things about my research. I would say that they are so intent on achieving their policy goals or preventing what they see as a disaster if they don't, that they are willing to certainly overlook confessional differences, but also sometimes even overlook national enmities, if you will. For instance, the World Congress of Families has become very, very tight with the Russian Orthodox Church. And in the period when the Crimean annexation took place, they were attacked a great deal by the left for being so close to an organization that itself was close to the Russian state. So that was a huge stress point. Some of these geopolitical things have conflicts between different parts of the world, create stresses on these alliances. But in that case, the World Congress of Families weathered that stress. And they are, again, I think, looking at what they see as the big picture on this issue. Namely, we need to defend the natural family. Russia and the Russian Orthodox Church is doing that. And as many of you may know, that gay rights are pretty repressed in Russia, and same-sex marriage isn't permitted. They overlook some of these differences. Same thing with the coalitions between these groups and the Muslim world. Obviously, there are a number of very conservative groups in the United States that are hugely anti-Muslim, but they're not involved in these kind of issues. The groups that care most about the family issues will overlook what other conservatives see as problems with Islam generally. And they basically respect Islam, and they certainly respect the diplomats they work with who help them hugely at the UN. Yes?
I see as a sign of the weakness in their argument that they have to solicit their enemies to become their friend to promote their agenda.
Yeah, you could see it that way, I guess. I mean, they're looking for allies, for sure. Any allies that they can find, they will take. I mean, I would only say that I think in any political conflict, people who are facing difficulties, or even people who are on the stronger side, will generally look for allies. And often they're not as picky as you might expect them to be, especially if they're kind of on the losing side. They want to have as many allies as possible, and they'll hold their noses or cover their eyes to certain things that these groups might be promoting anyway. Actually, one other interesting part of this, though, like the stress points, I had up there that I have on the cover of my book this picture of the protests regarding the Ugandan death to gays law. That, of course, was a truly extreme law, and much of the Traditional Values Coalition actually openly opposed the law. The Holy See was very active in saying, this is wrong. You know, we can criticize the sin, but we have to love the sinner, essentially. And other, I'd say, more mainstream conservative groups were adamantly opposed to this. But the human rights and LGBT rights groups tried to tar and blacken the name of the Traditional Values Coalition by pointing out that they were in bed with this government, which was saying, death to gays. So these coalitions are somewhat tenuous. Maybe it's a sign of desperation. You may be right about that. But they've actually lasted now for decades, and they've weathered a number of really significant storms. Yes?
Do the Asian countries have any predominant position on these things?
Well, Muslim Asian countries like Malaysia and Indonesia. Yeah. Well, let me just talk briefly about India, because that one I know for sure. India now, with the Hindu nationalist government, which is quite conservative, they are getting increasingly involved in this network as well, and have been opposed to a lot of the sort of what they see as sort of Western imperialist impositions through human rights and sexual rights. So it is truly international. Japan and Korea, I actually don't know enough about to really comment on, but certainly other Asian countries are involved. Yeah. Yes?
Yeah, the Roman Catholic Church, I'm not a Catholic, but I did spend a good bit of time teaching in a Catholic school.
Mm-hmm.
And I had the sense there that there was a very strong social justice effort. They had codified it as the Catholic social teachings.
Right.
And it seems to butt right up against what you're talking about.
That's a very good point. Now, I'm not a Catholic, but I've been teaching at Duquesne Catholic School for 20 years now. And the thing I've noticed there, and Duquesne is, I'd say, a very moderate Catholic school. But what I've noticed, and especially on my research on this issue, is that the Catholic Church is a very, very wide tent, broad tent. And it includes many in the laity and many priests who are deeply imbued with these ideas of social justice. And of course, that's been part of Vatican. It started with Vatican II, it even went well before that too. But it is something that has, I think, deeply affected at least certain wings of the Catholic Church. And yet it doesn't necessarily transfer over on certain issues. I mean, abortion being the most obvious one. But the idea of same-sex marriage, especially, is one that's been very, I think, difficult to swallow, even among those on the left of the Catholic Church who believe deeply in social justice. And then, of course, there's the Catholic hierarchy. I think, despite the fact that the current Pope is relatively liberal, the hierarchy is very staunchly against these sorts of developments. And they use their very powerful role at the UN to try to prevent change. So the Catholic Church is very interesting on this issue, also on the gun issue, by the way, where the Catholic Church hierarchy has been very much in favor of gun control internationally, but you have conservative lay Catholics who say that that's a huge mistake, and they have fought against, like I said, I worked in Brazil on some of the research, they fought against Brazil's efforts to control the sale of small arms back in the early 2000s, and were very, very effective. So these lay Catholics who totally rejected what the hierarchy said. So in that case, you could say the hierarchy was kind of on the progressive side, yeah, gun control side, but the others, you know, they found many within that wide tent who were totally opposed to it. I'll go to you, Ted, but any other questions who people haven't asked yet? Yeah.
I just had a question on the scientific side. Mm-hmm. There are a lot of organizations working, for example, on climate change. There's an undercurrent of, if it's scientifically accepted fact that's happening, we need to be dealing with it, and bickering about how it happened is no longer important, so work is happening there.
Right.
For gender identity, the WHO reclassified gender identity disorder as gender dysphoria as a medical condition. It's like there's an undercurrent of scientific. This ship is sailing, and
right,
a lot of these things are not up for scientific debate. So
right,
for those of us who follow, like, how do you have any recommendations on how we could help these culture wars ever not fall on either side, but rather follow up a moderate center? Because
yeah. Yeah, I agree that
it's ever evolving.
Right.
It just seems like fighting against things you don't want to see is very difficult.
Yeah, I mean, I think you got two questions there, really. One is about the science aspect of this. I think on these issues, you're right, the ship has sailed. The scientific consensus is very strong on these sorts of issues. Certainly on climate change, maybe a little bit less on sexual orientation, gender identity, but I think there's no question that the major scientific organizations view things one way, but there are dissenters among scientists, and more importantly, there is a different worldview among some, certainly most in these networks, about the role of science, even, and what, you know, whether science, or I guess you could call it faith, is or biblical texts are what we should follow in these areas. And there are some nuanced positions here. I've made it much more black and white than it really is. I mean, I already suggested, you know, the Catholic Church has staked out this position of being against homosexuality, certainly against same-sex marriage, and being against LGBT rights as distinct from the human rights of all people, whatever their sexuality. So there may be some, there's room for compromise for sure, but given the nuance of these issues. And ultimately, governments do reach compromises in the form of laws. But what I think is striking here in my second book, the Rights as Weapons book, is mostly about this. These groups do not, the activist groups typically do not accept a new law as the ending point of a conflict. They will fight against it if they view that they've lost, or they will fight for even more if they think they've won. And the activist groups kind of drive at least what we perceive as the culture wars. They get the media attention. They try, of course, to get that media attention very hard so that they can get support for their causes. And I do think we have compromises in many different countries, but that doesn't mean that we see an end to the conflict. And conflict, as I say, is really deep, even to what is scientific knowledge. I thought I saw another hand up somewhere, but yes.
My question had to do with who's financing both sides. You mentioned Arbus, I'm not familiar
right.
with Arbus. But how much money are governments, like the Russian government, putting into these efforts? Where's the money coming?
Yeah, that's a difficult question to ask, but obvious answer, but a very important one, obviously. The Russian Orthodox Church is, a Russian it's a state church, so they do get money from the state for sure. And of many Orthodox churches are state churches as well. So that is one source of money. There are huge numbers of small donors on both sides, which make, I think, some difference. And then there are the large foundations and big donors. The Arcus Foundation is on the left. It's been promoting human gay rights specifically for years, but better known ones also are very much involved in this on the left. On the right, groups, I actually didn't look into the funding specifically like this on this, but so I'm somewhat going out on a limb here, and I'm not absolutely sure about this, but I think I shouldn't really say. But there's clearly going to be major foundations on the right that are promoting this and giving lots of money to these organizations, especially the ones that are kind of high-cost organizations, like the legal defense organizations that employ lawyers who could make millions of dollars if they worked in private practice, and are instead devoting themselves to what they see as sort of public interest law. And they are being paid very well in these legal defense organizations. And I doubt it's simply from small donors. I think there clearly are some very large foundations on the right as well, and some other states besides the Russian state as well. Oh, actually, one other thing I would say is, many Western European governments have given a lot of funding to gay rights groups as well. So it's not purely non-governmental versus governmental. Both sides have these networks that encompass both the non-governmental and the governmental sides here. So, Ted, did you have another question?
I have lots, but the one that was on my mind is the trickiness of defining what a traditional family is when there are faith traditions, or there are traditions that include things like polygamy.
Right. No, absolutely. And I think the Mormon Church's involvement in this traditional values network is kind of, in some ways, kind of ironic, as you're suggesting, or some of the Muslim groups as well. But again, this is one of those things that they have overcome in an effort to achieve the goals they think are so central. And I guess to some extent a tension point. And you're right, all of these terms are very vague, but they are defined by the political actors in certain ways. It's and certainly the traditional or natural family is, as I said, you know, the union of man and woman with children, and the man kind of generally in the position of the leader of the family, and the woman focusing on raising children, which and they see as the most important thing anyway. But that's it's an area of a lot of controversy too. So. Anyway, well, any other questions or? Oh, time's up. Yeah, okay. Well, thank you very much then.